This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to Amazon.com/comedy ad free. That's Amazon.com/comedy ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to Spark.
We tell true stories.
We tell them live.
And we tell them across the UK. Today we continue our stories of escape.
With our host, Gigi. Hello again, people. We managed to rope a few people into coming and telling their story. And I'd encourage anyone to do it and to prove to you that anyone could do it. Let me tell you a stupid thing I did. So we made it to New York, and I started to try to make friends, and my parents had to leave us at home. We were 10 and 8, and they just had to kind of trust that we wouldn't do anything stupid and get ourselves killed. So we lived in Queens, and our parents came home at 7 p.m., and they would leave at 7 a.m. So we had the whole day in the summer to kind of get into trouble. And there would be a gang of kids sort of running around the base of our 12-story building, just playing stupid games. So one of my first friends, who didn't have a very high IQ, in my opinion, but I needed her because I didn't have any friends. So I was just that day running around with her and doing whatever she suggested. And so she suggested something really stupid, but I did go along with it. And she said, well, how about this idea? Why don't we tie our wrists together? And you can just follow me around all day. And I thought, well, okay. And so we tied our wrists together with a very thin piece of rope. And there was about 5 feet between my wrist and her wrist. And walking around the outside of our building, I did that for a little while. And I said, you know, I don't want to do this anymore, Diane. And I'm not doing it anymore. And she said, sure you are. And she went into an elevator, the elevator at the base of the building. And somehow my terribly high IQ did not think, prevented me from seeing sort of the possible conclusions of this, because I was used to much more abstract thought. But anyway, she goes into the elevator, and I'm tied to her, and I'm like, I'm not going in that elevator. Yes, you are. No, I'm not. And so the elevator door starts to close. And you know how when something horrible is happening, how time kind of stretches? And so the time was stretching, kind of, and I could see sort of my hand kind of slowly going this way as the elevator door is closing, and then my hand is slowly going up the elevator door, and I had the time to actually think, my parents are going to be so mad that I've lost my hand, and, you know, within 5 months of being in New York as a new immigrant. And my hand is going up, and I hear Diane screaming from inside the elevator, ah, what do I do? And she's too dumb to just press the stop button. And I'm like, so here I go. I mean, I don't know what actually happens to a hand if it's... Luckily, the rope broke. You know, that was a happy ending to one of very many scrapes that we got into that my parents never knew about. Next storyteller is Julie.
Hello. I was 10 years old when I learned not to give too much importance to the authorities. because when the Nazis arrived in Hungary, we had to flee in 1 hour. And when I arrived to Budapest, my father was there with fake papers. And I did live 1 year with fake papers, going from one place to other. But I didn't consider myself, of course, migrant, even if we had to hide. So I realized that I was migrant only like 2 years ago when I heard that they don't want a Romanian in England. Because what they will do, they will come all over. And they didn't come. Because those who wanted came before. So when I was 18 years old, I lived in a communist Romanian dictator. I finished high school with very high degrees. From 100, I was the number 5 in a good order. And so I believed I would go soon to university. And then I received a letter. I am not allowed to go to university because my parents are not workers. And I cried. And I cried. And I decided I will not let myself being discriminated anymore. I will fight when something arrives next time. But a year later, my father found me a place to work like technician in the Chemical Research Institute. And then I learned that there was an open university which lets everyone who works, you had to be a worker yourself, and then you could go to open university. We were sent material and we could learn at home. And then twice a year, we would go to examination and with luck and a lot of work pass. Now, we begin 10,000, I think, but after 2 years, we were only 150 who persisted. I spent the years of 18 to 24 working and learning. And one day, a woman with a bad hair and looking more like someone who sweeps the floor than someone important came and told me, "I want this table." I got a small table just 2 years before. I had to work in a chemical laboratory. Usually they are high tables and high stools. But when I gave to my research chemist a good paper that she could use, she gave me a small table so I can write down our research. So I told her, "No. That is my table. I need it. Give it to me now." And she began to cry even more. As soon as she went out, I went nearby lab and I asked, "Do you know who is that crazy woman?" And she told me, "Oh, la 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 la, that is Elena Ceausescu. That is the future wife, communist chief wife." Okay, I didn't know. So next day, next morning, I came to work. And I was not allowed to go in. I was taken by 2 young men and told that you are lucky. Because we made investigation and we found out that you don't know with whom you were so not nice. But you cannot go anymore to work here because we wouldn't like her to see you. So they forbid me to work. I needed to go to work somewhere because I had to finish the university, and for to finish the university, I had to work. So I went in a place where I could work with my hands, like a manutentioner, and put etiquettes on bottles. And I worked there 1 month. But after 1 month, they told me, you cannot work anymore here. 2 weeks later, I went to university to give my last examination that would make engineer of me. And all the 6 years I worked and I studied will be rewarded now. And my name was not there. And I asked, what happened? And finally she told me, there is a paper here that you are enemy of state, enemy of people. What? And you are not allowed to go to any university in Romania, to any school. I went home. And what I can tell you, all the earth seemed gone out of me. My father found me someone who was 1 year in France, one who knew French, and I learned French 6 months, and then found me a university student of English, and I did begin to learn English for 6 months, but I still was very, very sad. Until I decided to go with my boyfriend all the way. And that helped me out. I was no more have been, I was now a woman. And I was very happy again. And the words seemed to open before me. And my father asked me, do we sign emigration papers to ask to get out of Romania? Because I couldn't work, I couldn't study, I couldn't do anything. And so finally I accepted it, even if it was to leave my friends and my home and everything there. It took us 2 years to go out and to receive the papers. And in these 2 years, I married. Because I believed they will never let me any way out. So my life was in limbo and I didn't want to continue anymore. And also, my mother died. And I went to the customs and they suspected that there is something hidden in my mother's ashes. So they took a newspaper and they thrown my mother's ashes on it. I almost fainted. And finally, I sit down and I fortified myself thinking that I will anyway take something that they don't know about. It was my future kid, which was born in a free country.
Thank you very much, Julie.
We'll return to the stories in just a second. But first,
we're asking listeners of this podcast to help the refugees of today.
If you can spare £5,
$10,
to help people fleeing war and persecution,
like Julie, like Hassan,
then head to stories.co.uk/donate.
Pause the podcast now
and give what you can to our chosen charity, Refugee Aid.
Go to stories.co.uk. Thank you.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things.
Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at UH1.com.
When have you had to make a quick exit and why? I'm 8 years old and I am at my afternoon language class learning French. This is 1987 in South Africa, and my class was one of the first multiracial schools. I hear a noise behind me, which is the classroom door opening, and see something flying into the room. There's a large bang, and the room fills with tear gas. We try to escape, but the door is locked. We are crying and screaming. We had to wait for the police to break down the door and help us out. I have no idea how long it took for us to be rescued. Thank you. Our next storyteller is Prue. Thank you.
Hi. Well, following that amazing story, I don't really have very much experience of having to escape. I'm very privileged in that sense, and I'm lucky to say that I've never really had to run away from anything serious. My life's never been in threat. My home's never been in threat. My beliefs have never been questioned. I've lived a pretty free and privileged life, and up until the 2nd of September last year, I considered myself to be really politically engaged, switched on. I thought I was up to speed with current affairs, that I did my bit. I was with friends, we were collecting things for the camps in Calais, and we were taking things there, and we were fundraising, and I was a really good keyboard warrior, just like hitting Facebook hard every day. Yeah, feeling really good about myself. And then one morning, it was the 2nd of September and I was on my way to work and I was running late and just kind of a bit preoccupied, and I had my latte and I was flicking through my phone, as you do, just kind of getting the tidbits of the news. And I'm sure you probably all saw the same picture, but I saw the picture of Aylan El-Kurdi's body on the beach in Turkey. And I think perhaps because I wasn't expecting it, it hit me really hard, and my initial reaction was kind of a denial, like, no, this is really bad, like, we shouldn't see things like this, you know, this shouldn't be allowed, you know, this is intrusive, what about his family, you know, I'm not comfortable with this. And then I kind of processed it a little bit, and I realised that was my fear and my kind of disbelief that was leading me to that conclusion. And I started to think about it a bit more, and I remembered my son when he was that age. I remembered the feel of him and the weight of him and, you know, his laughter and how alive he felt, just how vibrant and full of energy and just chunky he was. And I imagined that gone, and I just imagined that body still, and I started to cry. And I feel ashamed because it was selfish tears. I was considering how I would feel to lose my own child, but I was on this packed commuter train and I couldn't hold it in. And Oh, they were just streaming down my face, just kind of mascara everywhere, and I was snivelling. People would give me tissues, but, like, no one really knew what to do. They were all just kind of looking a bit like, oh, all right, love, calm down. So I kind of got off the train, and rather than, you know, change stops, and rather than carrying on with my journey, I had to sit down for a minute, and I just kind of had to gather my thoughts, and I thought, you know, this is... I can't do this anymore. I can't carry on being the keyboard warrior, you know, having people pat me on the back and go, you're doing really well, you do so much, oh my God, you put me to shame. Because I know in my heart that I'm not doing enough. I know in my heart that it's a conspiracy for me to do the little that I was doing and to feel good about it. So literally, I began to throw myself into it. I was like, I'm going to look into the eye of the storm now, and I'm going to really, really understand this, because I've been quite complacent. I've been doing enough to make me feel like I'm a good person, but not enough to really upset my personal status quo. So I started researching, and I joined loads of Facebook groups, and I just had this constant stream, 24/7 stream of really disturbing stuff that wasn't out there in the news. There was like this kind of weird blanket in the news at that time that, you know, certain stories were getting through, but you'd research this stuff and the numbers of people that were affected, I mean, it was millions of people. And there were camps all over Europe, and there were hotspots between those camps all over Europe, and people were everywhere. There was suffering on our own doorstep in Europe. So I decided that I needed to do something, and I'd already been helping out a little bit with a grassroots organisation that had a warehouse in my area, and my background's in press and media, so I thought, okay, I'm gonna do a bit more, and I'm gonna try to use my skills to do something different, to do something good, and escape from this feeling that I now have. So that's, I guess, my escape was like a personal escape. So I got involved with this group, and they're an amazing group called Cali Action. We do a lot of fundraising and a lot of advocacy, but at that time, the main drive was to get together aid. So we kind of were just collecting stuff from people all over the UK and bringing it all to London and sorting it all in a big warehouse and getting it ready to ship it out to various places. And one of our members had just been out to Samos, which is one of the tiny islands on the Aegean in Greece, which is the gateway to Europe. And it's one of the islands where, you know, lots and lots and lots of people come over in the boats, the smuggling boats that Hassan talked about earlier. We had organised a shipment that was going to go there. So I thought, OK, I'm going to go there and I'm going to receive it and I'm going to do a bit of an assessment of need and have a look and see, you know, what I can do to help. And prior to us sending the shipment, we knew that it was really bad there. Our founder, Libby, had gone out there and there'd been thousands of people just sleeping out literally on this concrete port. There was no shelter. There was no facility. There weren't even any tents. There were just women and children lying on these kind of mats and bits of kind of fabric that they'd been given. There were 12 Greek women who were cooking, feeding everyone, trying to clothe them with clothes from the island. I mean, bearing in mind, this is Greece, and they're in the middle of their own economic crisis, you know, and Samos is a very poor economy anyway. You know, it's an island, and there's not a lot of employment there, a lot of poverty. So these people were really, really desperate, and they were doing their very best. But the picture that we got when we got there was just so shocking that you had to actually steer yourself and take stock not to let it show on your face, because you would be meeting people who needed you to give them reassurance, who needed you to make them feel safe, and you would just be wanting to cry just looking at the situation and looking at the state they were in. And then simultaneously you'd be beating yourself up thinking, I'm so selfish to be feeling this way because this person needs me to be strong. So it's a massive learning curve. And one of the positive aspects was to see actually at that stage that physical aid was really helpful. People had nothing and they needed things. So to be able to go into the makeshift warehouse facility there and go, I know we have a pallet that's full of this because I put it there myself. And to open a box and to find the things that people needed was actually amazing. And I was really proud of us for having done that. So it's been 6 months now since we began, and I gave up my job in media. Firstly, because I was really busy and distracted, And then because I was doing this all of the time, that I didn't have time for it. And then every time that people called me, I wasn't available, so they just stopped calling me. Occasionally, they'll call me for a kind of refugee story. But apart from that, this is now what I do all of the time. And, you know, I feel very privileged to have made that escape, actually, to have had my eyes opened, because I do realise that I was sleepwalking through life a little bit. I was pretty complacent, you know, I was comfortable, so I wasn't really questioning things too much. But the situation that I find myself in now is a different one, because at the time, aid giving seemed like, you know, a really great thing, and I could see the need for it. You know, people needed things, we were supplying the things, everyone was rallying around, the whole country was sending things, it was amazing. You got this real sense of pride in humanity and in people's hearts and people's generosity, because we raised huge amounts of money. I mean, one particular campaign was over the course of 5 days, and I think we raised somewhere in the region of £20,000 in 5 days, which is astounding. People just gave, and they didn't know us from Adam. They just trusted us. They saw a need, and they just gave us money, and we set about putting that money into the right places, and we did so much, and things were great. Things were really starting to work on Samos. I go back and forward all the time. So they got to a point where I felt like, you know, okay, this is really grim. This is a pretty awful situation. People are in a pretty desperate state, but they come here, they're fed, they're clothed, they have shelter, and we're doing it with love. We're even finding a bit of time to do other activities like crocheting and English lessons. You know, it's great. And people are generally pretty happy there. You know, I've been to a lot of other camps and facilities and seen the depression that sets in when people aren't being respected and treated with love, and it's very different from Samos. Samos is unique because the local authority there, the municipality, they have sort of meshed in with the volunteers, and they want to deliver the program that we're bringing, and they want to do it with love as well, which is really amazing. However, what's now happened there, it's becoming a hotspot, an EU hotspot. So one of the kind of difficulties of campaigning to get the whole crisis acknowledged politically is that the kind of tail end of that is that the sting in the tail, let's say, is that when you bring in the EU and when you bring in the UN and you say, acknowledge this problem, this is happening, you have to deal with it, they come in and do it their way. And their way doesn't really involve much love. So what's actually happened in Samos is we desperately wanted the authorities to come in. We got everything going fine, and we were sort of spinning these plates and saying, come on then, you know, where's the big guys? Come in and save us. Now you take over from here and you do it right. And they came along, and what they did was took the whole heart out of all of it, and they've dismantled the entire camp as it was set up at the time. They've moved it all into one big facility. And they've done it in a manner that's really disorganised. So actually, people are back to square one again. They're arriving, there's no one to receive them. There isn't enough food for everybody because they haven't had the time to do the calculations to work out how much food they need to provide. And because they don't speak to the volunteers, because we're not officially recognised, they haven't got any of our information about the numbers of people or the needs of people. So right now, I'm in a point of sheer frustration because I don't really see the end to this situation. I feel like we all expect that there's some kind of authority that's operating in the world that's going to take care of everything. There's they, the big they, who are going to come in and sort everything out. And I thought that the they was the UN. And I thought that they was the EU. And that's who we've wanted to take control of the situation. And now they've come in. And in actual fact, they're not fixing it, they're making it worse. And this has led me to believe that aid giving and volunteering and all of those things that we do that are really amazing are just a sticking plaster. And that this whole situation is not going to get any better without a political resolution, because in actual fact, charity shouldn't even really exist. It shouldn't be necessary in Europe with all the provisions that we have here and all of the money that we have here, it shouldn't be necessary for people to have to send their secondhand baby grows to children on an island elsewhere in Europe, because we have the means to fix this politically. We've done it before and we can do it again. And it's a lack of political will that has put us in this position. So now I feel, although of course we're going to keep on and we're going to keep volunteering and we're going to keep fundraising and we're going to keep doing what we do, what we really need to be doing is asking the pertinent question, which is, why is this happening? Why are we allowing people's human rights to be disregarded? We all need to start lobbying and we need to actually start to look for a political solution, because as long as we keep putting the sticking plaster on, I think everybody's going to be happy for us to do that. And we're never going to escape from this cycle, which is basically that there is neglect there and the people that really care and really feel bad will come and they will fill a hole and the situation will never be resolved.
Thanks to Julie, Prue, and everyone who told a story in this episode.
Remember that you can help at stories.co.uk/donate.
And one last thing, people of Glasgow, we have a Spark event for you.
On the 21st of March,
we'll be telling true stories on the theme Unbecoming.
Stories of unflattering activities
and untoward affairs. That's Monday, 21st of March, at the Flying Duck in Glasgow.
Full details at stories.co.uk.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.